You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll continue our coverage of the controversial arrest and video of that arrest of a young black woman in Madison with Madison Police Chief Mike Koval.
First, our next guest says a legal challenge to Wisconsin's election district boundaries could have an impact beyond the state's borders.
A federal lawsuit filed by a group of voters argues that Wisconsin's assembly districts were drawn in an unfair way that marginalizes Democratic votes. A trial wrapped up in a federal court earlier this summer. All parties now waiting for a three-judge panel to issue their ruling.
The case is seen as likely to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. If the challenge is upheld, it could set a new precedent for cases of alleged gerrymandering in Wisconsin and beyond.
Roger Bybee has been writing about this issue for The Progressive and The American Prospect. He joins us now in our studio in Milwaukee. Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Now, you're hoping in general that this legal challenge is successful. What do you see as the impact of the district boundaries as drawn by Republicans here in Wisconsin?
Well, fundamentally, it's really been undemocratic with a small d in its impact in terms of disenfranchising people, particularly Democratic constituencies, that their votes have been effectively discounted and are worth a lot less.
And the state argument in part was that Republicans won the election in 2010. State law gives them the power to draw those lines. So this is democracy in action, in effect. What do you say to that?
Well, I'd say it's a pretty grotesque version of democracy and not worthy of the term democracy. In 2012, for example, there was 174,000 more votes for Democratic assembly candidates. So the Democrats had a very clear majority among all the assembly votes, and that was somewhat reflective of President Obama winning about 52-53% of the vote. But yet the Republicans, because of their redistricting, on which they spent $2 million in secrecy behind closed doors, wound up with having 60 of the assembly seats and the Democrats having just 39. And that kind of distortion, I think, is really a fundamental attack on one of the pillars of our democracy.
One of the points you make in the pieces we mentioned is that this isn't just a Wisconsin story. If this is upheld, this could set new standards. If this challenge is upheld, it could set standards around the country. What kind of impact could this have?
It could have a huge impact in a number of states that became entirely under Wisconsin control after the Republican landslide in 2010.
So under state, Republican control.
Yes, Republican control in 2010. So it's states like North Carolina, Michigan, Ohio, and several others. These were part of a systematic Republican effort called Red Maps that was nationally coordinated and funded with about $30 million to very carefully design both state legislative and congressional districts to maximize the number of Republican seats, all out of proportion to what their Democratic share would be.
People have argued that we've seen cases in states like Illinois where Democrats, when given the opportunity to gerrymander, to draw weird maps, have taken advantage of that. So it's maybe not great, but at least it's equal opportunity, not great. Whoever wins the election, whoever puts that effort into it, gets to draw those lines.
I would certainly condemn that very strongly. It's also the case in California and a couple other states where the Democrats have abused the redistricting process. But right next to us, we have a very positive model in Iowa, where for the last 35 years, a neutral state body has done the redistricting to use natural constituencies like not dividing cities, not dividing counties, and so forth, which were involved in the Republican redistricting of Wisconsin, which splits up 58 counties out of our 72 counties. And in Iowa, they've come up with a redistricting system that is really fair. And I think Wisconsin ought to move in that direction so that the process is nonpartisan and really democratically represents the votes of the public.
Talking to Roger Bybee about a legal challenge to Wisconsin's district boundaries drawn a few years back in federal court now, that challenge. Roger, this can feel like a wonky legal issue. Why should people, why should voters worry about how these election district lines end up being drawn?
Because our pillars of democracy are really under attack. Nothing can be more basic than having your vote really count. And under the present system, the votes of a large share of the population simply don't matter because Democratic voters are crammed into districts while Republicans are assigned majorities by the redistricting maps so that they carry a share of the seats in our legislature that are all out of proportion to the actual popular vote. And so we can see that. We also see it with the kind of voter ID / voter suppression law which was enacted. That's a whole other topic, but I think we are seeing a very broad and very fundamental attack on our democracy in Wisconsin. And we've had one of the most vital traditions of democracy across the entire nation.
One of the trickiest things about cases of alleged gerrymandering, of weird lines being drawn to benefit one party or the other, is that it can be hard to prove. People don't even know it when they see it. Would this challenge help courts set a standard to help define what gerrymandering is in Wisconsin or anywhere for that matter?
Yes. The Supreme Court, especially Justice Kennedy, has been looking for exactly this kind of case to begin to draw up some guidelines. And so whichever side prevails in this Wisconsin lawsuit, it's likely to find the case before the U.S. Supreme Court, and we will get some kind of resolution to this. Let me just back up a bit and about the process. We have to keep in mind that the Republicans did this redistricting entirely behind closed doors of a Republican-connected law firm. They didn't even let Republican legislators see anything but their own proposed districts. Democratic legislators, the media, the public were entirely shut out. And judges overseeing the process continually admonished the Republican lawyers for their foot dragging and their deceptions. It was a very ugly process. The Republican lawyers were eventually fined $17,000+. So there's all kinds of wrongdoing connected with the way that Wisconsin was redistricted.
Roger, as we wrap up, supposing this does go to the U.S. Supreme Court, as a lot of people think it will, it could be an 8-member Supreme Court, it could be an 8-member and a player to be named later. What do you think are the prospects of this challenge to Wisconsin's redistricting in a U.S. Supreme Court?
The legal experts to whom I've spoken seem to feel pretty optimistic that the Supreme Court will find the Wisconsin redistricting totally out of bounds because it's so disproportionately disenfranchises a large share of the electorate. So the legal folks I've spoken to are pretty optimistic that the Wisconsin redistricting will be tossed out.
Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be with you. A pleasure.
That was Roger Bybee. He wrote about the Wisconsin redistricting lawsuit in the American Prospect and the Progressive magazine.
We're continuing our coverage of the arrest earlier this month of Janelle Laird, a young African-American woman. Her arrest was caught on video and it went viral. In the video, 18-year-old Laird is confronted outside of a mall in Madison by two white male police officers who used force, including a taser, and physical force to restrain her. Laird allegedly argued with mall employees over a stolen phone and threatened security guards with a knife, which police said was recovered later from her backpack.
The video has caused controversy in the community, and it's gotten national attention. Some say the police used too much force to restrain her. Others say the police handled the situation appropriately. Talked to guests yesterday who said the police used excessive force. Now we're hearing from Madison Police Chief Mike Koval. He joins us now. Chief Koval, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
Well, this video is out there. A lot of people reacting to it. Some people saying, well, the video just shows part of the story. Can you set a little wider context of what people maybe didn't see of what you think might have misled people in watching just the video?
Well, and even in the lead-up to the intro of this entire incident, it should be noted that this call probably lasted from beginning, middle, and end, closer to almost 15 minutes. So there was much happening in the Easttown Mall food court prior to our arrival. And to a slight correction in that, not only did the defendant at that time threaten that she had a knife and that she would be willing to use it against the security, the mall security, but that was the second of the two victims. Initially, there was a threat made to an individual at Taco Bell that she believed had been the thief of her cell phone. So there had been a lot of talk and discussion. There had been actually two incidents then of threatening behavior, indicating that there was a knife involved, and coupled with language that was the case in terms of the threats. But again, I think I've seen but one time the short version, the minute or so, as well as a more extended version, which I think goes up to 6 minutes, but mm-hmm. That's, again, you're looking at a snapshot that doesn't begin to discuss all of the context that's needed for a moving picture that had that many minutes.
And people have seen, I think in many cases, that longer video and maybe read the police complaint that summed up some of the information you just shared. The reaction seems to be split. Some people saying this person had demonstrated threatening behavior, had displayed mm-hmm. a weapon earlier. The police use of force is appropriate. Other people saying it appears that the police had control of the situation. People feeling the taser, knee strikes, things like that were excessive. How do you weigh that in a situation like this?
Well, again, we have very strongly articulated case law from the United States Supreme Court. The case law has also been codified into some fairly rigorous continuum of force issues and discussions that are trained not just in the state of Wisconsin but throughout the country. We obviously get as our template of options that can be used in any given situations depending on what the officer, subject, factors or variables are. We get ours from the Law Enforcement Standards Board from the state of Wisconsin. That's what everybody in Wisconsin is trained against. So what we have to do now, and I agree that there is quite a dichotomy of thought on this, is that we have taken the steps to farm this out to an independent the Dane County Sheriff's Department, where their subject matter master trainer will basically apply the template of what's acceptable to those facts that they've seen. And all I'd ask is that people suspend judgment one way or the other until such time as we finally get that finding next week, I hope.
Yesterday we heard from Eric Upchurch with the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. I want to give a brief listen to some of what he had to say.
Okay. The community should be able to say, this isn't right, and we should be able to treat this case in a truly restorative fashion where we're holding the City of Madison Police Department accountable for their actions. Madison Police Department isn't being held accountable here.
So him saying there should be a community standard that holds police accountable, one of your predecessors, David Cooper, saying, yes, there are those legal standards, yes, there are state guidelines, the community can demand and expect different standards above and beyond that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that obviously I agree that the community should have a substantive element in who's hired, how they're trained, and what does that training look like, what are its points of emphasis. and who holds officers accountable. I would suggest that I can click off a number of ways that the police are going to ultimately be held responsible. The folks I'm talking to right now, the Fourth Estate, are an obvious one. This has clearly been in the public forum and roundly debated, discussed, and may lead to some policy or substantive state law changes, for all I know, for all we know, because of this sort of traction. You have the Police and Fire Commission. Those are five citizens. They're not beholden to the police department. People can complain directly to them on any use of force or other complaint matters, or they can use our own internal affairs. And if they don't like the internal affairs finding from our own city, they can go to the PFC as sort of a second court of appeal for an independent finding. Similarly, we are obviously held responsible through civil litigation, liability from that standpoint. If it was excessive, then you could have the Department of Justice look at a civil rights violation through the federal courts. And let's not forget a sort of obtuse way, but ultimately, there's even a legislative process in here. I can remember a couple of years ago now when the very landlocked legislature of Wisconsin, owing to citizen involvement and participation, when those folks couldn't agree where to go to lunch, somehow or another, they managed to come up with a law that puts Wisconsin at the top of the list for those states that require an independent investigation by another agency whenever there's a critical incident involving an officer shooting another person. So I guess I tend to disagree with that one-sided notion that there's no community involvement or not enough of it.
Talking to Madison Police Chief Mike Koval about police and use of force and police relations with communities and with minority communities. With all that you just listed, Chief Koval, do your officers maybe feel like they're under too much of a microscope, too much scrutiny? There's been the talk about the so-called Ferguson effect. Does it make it harder, you think, for your officers to do their jobs?
Well, I think without a doubt it sort of comes with the terrain. But again, that's up to me as the leader to say, let's reject the narrative that's being written elsewhere. Let's still march to the tune of our own drummer, park that squad car, and make an affirmative attempt to be even more engaging, even more relational, do more listening, and do more explaining as we do things with people. But there's no doubt, we just had an incident literally last night where there was a group of juveniles having a disturbance in the mall, in the same food court at Easttown, and officers were sent. And ultimately, cameras were out everywhere. The officers did exactly what they did. They defused the situation without incident. And at the end of the day, though, when I happened to see that incident, I called the supervisor who was sent, and I said, how did it go? And she says, it was really different. Everybody had this sort of feeling of being very uncomfortable. And I think that's to be expected based on the recency of what's occurred here in Madison.
And of course, we have this national conversation where many members, younger members in particular of minority communities, feel uncomfortable in a different way. They feel like they're unfairly targeted, maybe get different treatment overtly or accidentally from police officers. How do you weigh those concerns?
Oh, I think that you have to accept them, because who else but those young people that are commenting that those are very unique and lifelong experiences in their life. And they didn't just create that impression overnight. Whenever I have a new class convened, I always have the entire class, I say, raise your hand if you've ever been pulled over by the cops. Okay, how about 5 times, 10 times, 15 times? And it pains me to see that by the time I go through this ritual every year, the folks who have their hands in the air the longest are typically my recruit candidates of color and my women. So those are very real. Those are very visceral. And so we have to continue to do more to break down those barriers, historical or otherwise, and try to do more engagement so that people can see sort of beyond these cultural competencies that seem to be lacking for some, and that we have to do a better job of educating.
We heard from the department that since you've been in your position there, you've attempted to take a guardian approach to policing. Yep. in the community. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, basically, it actually started while I was still the sergeant directing the recruit class almost 4 years ago now. And basically, what I think part of the problem is in a post-911 world, and the police are complicit in this, is that we've become increasingly militarized under the auspices that the ends justifies the means when it comes to public safety, and through media reports and popular narratives that we see in movies and things. Increasingly, the cops look more like a warrior. The ends justifies the means, that there's very little to worry about in terms of process and procedure. And that's regrettable. And I think we have to change or complete a paradigm shift in which we look at a guardian mindset as being entirely more inclusive, that rules do matter, that we can't accept or tolerate ancillary or collateral damages, and that we have to look at ourselves as vanguards of those who protect constitutional and individual rights. I think that's infinitely more inviting aesthetically, and if you adopt it at one level, I hope that you can inculcate it into your culture at a more substantive level.
Best case, what do you hope comes out of this controversy over this video, over this arrest of Janelle Laird, over the issue of police use of force? What would be the best outcome of the conversation we're having now?
Well, I think we've already started towards a better outcome than normal, because but for the fact that these officers were willing to enter into a restorative judgment sort of court option, we are now at the point where you can see that the officers are doing more than just talking it. Good talk. They're walking the walk when they say that their pledge to community policing is in fact what they're saying it is. We're not so concerned that the outcome be punitive. We're concerned that the outcome be restorative and the best possible resolution. So I think even in the 2 to 3 days following this situation, that we've already attempted to show some healing, some reconciliation, and hopefully from that will come with peer circles an opportunity to have not just dialogues in this immediate case, but to have greater dialogue in so many other contexts across the city.
Chief Koval, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard.
That's Mike Koval. He's chief of the Madison Police Department. In the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this morning, reporter Daniel Bice reports that Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson is taking up the case for vaping, arguing against the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's efforts to regulate e-cigarettes.
Senator Johnson says he became aware of the issue thanks to Wisconsin conservative talk show host Vicki McKenna on WISN in Madison, who says that vaping is helping her kick a 23-year smoking habit and that regulating the e-cigarette market, quote, may actually kill people.
Why would you do that when they are producing a product that, number one, helps people who fail trying to quit smoking cigarettes, a deadly product, helps them quit, improves their health substantially, contributes to the tax base of the Wisconsin economy and the national economy, and is an overall net positive for public health? Why would you ban that product?
There's been a lot of debate over the costs and benefits of vaping. Supporters like McKenna say it's a much healthier alternative to cigarette smoking. Critics worry about the lack of testing, possible health consequences, and that vaping might be a gateway to smoking for kids.
Stanton Glantz is with us now. He's professor of medicine and distinguished professor of tobacco control in the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. Stanton, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
So we just heard that clip there featuring conservative talk show host Vicki McKenna. What is your take on her claim there that these are aids that help people quit smoking and that it's a net positive?
Well, the e-cigarette companies certainly promote e-cigarettes with the claim that they help people quit smoking. And there's no question that some people have actually successfully quit smoking with e-cigarettes. But we looked at the entire world literature as of a few months ago, over 20 studies. And when you put them all together, on average, smokers who use e-cigarettes are about a third less likely to quit smoking than smokers that don't use them. So while there are some individuals who do successfully quit with e-cigarettes, for the overwhelming majority of smokers, they actually keep them smoking. So in fact, the effect of e-cigarettes to keep smokers smoking is probably one of the most dangerous things about them.
As an expert in tobacco control, what is your take on why using a tobacco substitute wouldn't help people stop smoking?
Well, most people who use e-cigarettes don't substitute the e-cigarettes for conventional cigarettes. They add them to the conventional cigarettes. They're what are called dual users. And so while nobody completely understands the social dynamics that are involved, what a lot of people think is e-cigarettes are used as a way to bridge between cigarettes when you're in smoke-free environments and other places that you can't smoke. And that's why it's so very important to include e-cigarettes in clean indoor air laws, as several states and about 500 communities have already done.
What do we know about the relationship between e-cigarette users who are not already smokers? Do we know if someone uses e-cigarettes, that kind of product, that they're less likely to begin smoking tobacco?
No, it's actually the other way around, and this is one of the big concerns. E-cigarette use among kids is just exploding, and a substantial fraction of the kids who are using e-cigarettes have a risk profile that where you would doubt that they would start nicotine with smoking. But kids who initiate nicotine use with e-cigarettes are about four times more likely to go on and be smoking conventional cigarettes a year later than kids who don't use e-cigarettes. So there's a huge gateway effect. And this is being aggravated by the extensive mass media marketing of e-cigarettes and all the kid-friendly flavors that they're available in.
What do we know about how safe these kinds of products are, things like e-cigarettes, vape pens, and other related products?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that inhaling a puff on an e-cigarette isn't as dangerous as inhaling a puff on a cigarette, because whereas cigarettes deliver an aerosol of ultrafine particles and nicotine deep into your lungs as a way of delivering the addictive drug nicotine, and they do that by burning the tobacco, which generates a lot of combustion products and cancer-causing chemicals and other bad chemicals. E-cigarettes generate that aerosol of ultrafine particles by heating up a liquid. So there's much, much fewer cancer-causing chemicals in an e-cigarette aerosol than cigarette smoke. But cancer isn't the only disease that kills smokers. And in fact, most smokers are killed by heart disease and non-cancer lung disease. And the particles that e-cigarettes generate, as well as formaldehyde and some other aldehydes, trigger inflammatory processes, which are increase your risk of heart disease and cause problems in terms of lung function. So, you know, I think if someone were to switch entirely from a cigarette to an e-cigarette, they are at a lower disease risk, but it's probably still substantial, maybe somewhere in the range of a third to a half as bad as cigarettes are.
We're talking about the regulation of e-cigarettes and other products like that right now. In the news today, Senator Ron Johnson is opposing some regulation on e-cigarettes and products that are similar to that by the FDA. And we're talking with Stanton Glantz right now, professor of medicine and distinguished professor of tobacco control in the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. And in terms of what may be in the liquids themselves, you're saying so far it looks like the liquids would be less harmful than say, the nicotine, the combustion there. Do we know, though, do we have sufficient information about what is in that liquid?
Well, no, and that's one of the problems and one of the things that the FDA, albeit extremely slowly, is talking about doing because, you know, if it's, you know, even though it's almost certain that e-cigarettes aren't as dangerous as cigarettes, that's a little bit like saying jumping out of the 20th story of a building isn't as dangerous as jumping out of the 50th story of the building. And one real problem that people have when you buy an e-cigarette or go into a vape shop and mix your own mixture of liquids is you don't really know what you're getting. There's no quality control. There's not even disclosure of what's in the vaping liquid. And one of the things the FDA is doing, and by the way, the FDA is not prohibiting e-cigarettes or prohibiting anyone from vaping. So the talk show host you were quoting is like worrying about something that nobody has suggested. But one of the things the FDA is saying is that what's in the liquid and what we know about the health effects of those things in the liquid have to be reported to the government. And then it someday, probably years from now, could theoretically put regulations in place for minimum quality or prohibiting including some particularly dangerous chemicals.
Well, let's talk about what else the FDA is saying, starting with what they're looking for e-cigarettes and young people. What do they want there?
Well, the FDA set the minimum age to purchase e-cigarettes at 18. That won't have much effect because most of the states have already done that. A really important element of the rule that the FDA set up to the White House would have prohibited flavors, including menthol, unless the manufacturers could make an affirmative case that including those flavors was good for public health. That was a tremendously important provision in the rule because flavors are just crucial to attracting kids, and the Obama White House cut that out of the rule. So probably the most important public health actual rule that the FDA tried to implement was cut out by the White House.
Why did the White House choose to do that?
Well, you know, they've been asked by the press and nobody's talking. You know, I think that it was quite appalling because the health community has for years been demanding that the FDA act on flavors, in particular menthol, which is very important for attracting African Americans, young people and women to smoke and keeping them smoking. The FDA rule had 17 pages of science in it justifying not prohibiting menthol and these other flavors, but putting the responsibility on the manufacturers to demonstrate that it was good for public health to include them. And the White House just redlined it. I mean, it was shocking when I saw it.
So those are as a snapshot of what the FDA is looking for when it comes to e-cigarettes and young people. And earlier you were mentioning a bit about what could happen with regulation of ingredients. What else falls under that kind of a regulation list?
Well, the one other thing that the FDA had in the rule was to start putting warning labels on e-cigarettes and other tobacco products like cigars, which is an important step forward. Another thing which is beyond regulation, but the FDA has been running several very high-quality mass media educational campaigns about tobacco products, smokeless tobacco, cigarettes. And, you know, I would hope that they would start educating the public about e-cigarettes because there's a large number of people who think they're harmless when they're not, who think that they're just breathing in harmless water vapor, which is another claim that the industry often makes, which is just simply a lie. There is no water in e-cigarettes. It's propylene glycol, glycerol, nicotine, and other flavorants with some heavy metals and other things that boil off the heating element. And, you know, those are the, and then, as I said, the FDA had wanted to start regulating flavors, which would be tremendously important, but the Obama White House deleted that from the rule without explanation.
We're talking right now about the safety of vaping, things like vape pens, e-cigarettes, talking about whether it's an effective way to help people quit smoking, and also looking at regulations that the FDA is considering would like when it comes to the way that these products are regulated.
I'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What's your take on vaping, on e-cigarettes? Do you use them? Do you sell them? Have you used them to quit smoking? Have you seen kids using them? Do you see kids starting maybe a nicotine habit in your school, in your community? Are you worried about the possible health risks, or do you think, hey, it's way better than smoking the real thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our discussion now of whether e-cigarettes, vape pens, other nicotine delivery systems are healthy, whether they can help people quit smoking safely and their impact on children, and FDA regulations may be in the works on these products.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you use vape pens or e-cigarettes to quit smoking? How effective do you think they've been for you? Do you think the FDA should regulate these kinds of products? And what is your take on how these nicotine delivery products are being marketed to young people? What would you like to see? And is there anything there that might cross the line for you? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stanton Glantz stays with us now. He's a professor of medicine and distinguished professor of tobacco control in the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. We take our first caller now. We've got Patrick on the line in Madison. Patrick, hi.
Thanks for having this topic. I think it's really great to open the public discussion to it. I think that the doctor commented on some of the questions I had, but, you know, the comment of, oh, this is safer, I think is really a dangerous comment for anybody to make, because without any some sort of regulation and some sort of labeling about what's in these products, you just don't know. You don't know what kind of interstitial lung disease it could cause, or could it cause cancer or some different sort of cancer that tobacco smoking doesn't cause. We just don't know. And to your guest's comment about jumping out the window, you know, I think that even more appropriately, it'd be like jumping out a window and not knowing what floor it's on at all. Because without some sort of regulation about what is in these products, we're not going to be able to do the studies. We're not going to be able to collect the data we need to know about what kind of disease it may or may not be causing in humans.
Patrick, thanks so much. Lots of great thoughts there. And Patrick, getting at the question marks that remain surrounding e-cigarettes, and a lot of the science that is out there is new, as are these products. But Stanton, what do you think are the big lingering questions about this sort of product? And what do we need to know before we can make educated decisions?
Well, I think Patrick did hit the nail on the head. We really don't know precisely how bad they are. As I said, just looking at the physics and chemistry of what the person is inhaling, you would think they wouldn't be as bad as a cigarette. But the interesting thing that we see as the science is developing is, you know, a 6 months or a year ago, there was a group in England that came out and said, oh, e-cigarettes are 95% safer than cigarettes. And this has been widely promoted by the e-cigarette industry, but just a couple of months ago, there was a very well-done study that came out of Italy showing in terms of effects on your blood vessels in ways that are very intimately tied to developing heart disease and having heart attacks. E-cigarettes were as bad as smoking a cigarette, even though you're getting less bad stuff. There are also several studies that have come out recently showing that in terms of effects on the lung function and measures of inflammation in the lungs, they're as bad as a conventional cigarette. But, you know, the important thing everyone has to keep in mind is that most of the discussion people are having about e-cigarettes is just simply comparing them to cigarettes and saying, like, well, would you be better off with a cigarette or an e-cigarette? But the dominant behavior by 80 or 90% of people who use them is to keep smoking the cigarettes at the same time. So what you end up doing is actually increasing the total amount of bad stuff you're putting into your body. You're still getting all the bad stuff from the cigarette, and then you're adding on the additional, slightly different bad stuff from the e-cigarette.
Is there any evidence that people are using both at the same time, but maybe smoking nicotine less? So they're using both, but less cigarette smoking?
The evidence on that is quite mixed. There are some studies that show that people who use e-cigarettes smoke fewer cigarettes. There are other studies that actually show that they smoke more cigarettes. But in terms of some of the important diseases that smoking causes, particularly heart disease, the effect is highly nonlinear. So if you just smoke a little bit, a few cigarettes a day, you're getting almost the same risk for heart disease as if you were smoking a pack a day. So even if the e-cigarettes are leading people to smoke a few cigarettes a day less, that's probably not having any consequential effect on your health. And again, for most smokers, using e-cigarettes cuts the likelihood they'll quit smoking by a third, which is a huge effect. So even if a puff on an e-cigarette is a little bit less dangerous than a puff on a cigarette, if the net effect is to keep a lot of people smoking cigarettes who otherwise would have simply quit, that's a huge public health problem.
Patrick, thanks again for the call. Next, we're going to go to Clayton in Green Bay. Hi, Clayton.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I just wanted to throw out there that I'm not a kid. I'm 43 years old, and I've been using an e-cigarette of one form or another for a little over 3 years. I used it to stop smoking. I no longer smoke cigarettes. And my lung function is better. My heart sounds good. My doctor has told me I've had improvements in both. I find I don't get winded as easy as I used to. And, you know, another comment I would like to throw out there, I understand the concern about flavors towards children, but one of the things the flavors do is it allowed me as an adult to have an alternative to something that tastes like a cigarette. And now I'm to the point where if I do occasionally take a puff of somebody's cigarette, it tastes horrible. So, you know, I probably wouldn't switch back to cigarettes because they don't taste good anymore.
Clayton, thanks a lot for that. Interesting there, Clayton. One person there, but he's saying they've been pretty successful, e-cigarettes, and giving him an alternative.
I congratulate you, Clayton, on successfully quitting smoking. I would say now you should get off the e-cigarettes, too. But, and again, there are some people who, like Clayton, have successfully quit smoking with e-cigarettes. But for the great majority of people who use them, they actually make it harder to quit smoking. And so, you know, there's no question that if a smoker switched entirely from smoking cigarettes to smoking e-cigarettes, you are exposing yourself to fewer bad chemicals. But again, that's not what most people do. I mean, the one thing I would tell a smoker who's thinking about using e-cigarettes to quit smoking is, first of all, the evidence is that they're not going to help for most people. But if you insist on doing it, you have to quit the cigarettes. You know, continuing to smoke cigarettes and e-cigarettes at the same time is a terrible idea.
Clayton, thanks for that call. And just a couple of seconds left, Stanton, but in your opinion, do these regulations proposed by the FDA, do they do enough?
No. I mean, the FDA, the White House should have let the FDA take action on flavors. The FDA needs to do something to rein in the out-of-control advertising that's going on for e-cigarettes and attracting a huge number of kids. But, you know, the most important regulation of e-cigarettes isn't something the FDA can even do, and that is including them in clean indoor air laws. That's something that's going on at the local and state level, and that's something I think is the single most important policy to implement around e-cigarettes, plus educating people that they're not safe and that they tend to help or they tend to keep people smoking cigarettes.
Stanton, thanks a lot for joining us. That was Stanton Glantz, professor of medicine and distinguished professor of tobacco control in the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine.